Good to see you guys there. Good to see you this morning. A lot of you know that I am leaving tomorrow for a missions trip to Barcelona, and I'm excited about that. We'll pray about that before I leave today. But I'm excited. I'm never excited to leave my family for a few days, but I am excited about your guest speaker for next Sunday morning, Milton Harding. He and I ran into one another at a conference just a couple of months back, and we hit it off immediately. But that says more about Milton than it does about me. I suspect he's the sort of guy that just hits it off with everyone. But he's the CEO of Agape Solutions, which is a ministry. He is a super encouraging guy. I mean, just to look at him kind of makes you smile. And I'm super excited about him being here with you. He was a former chaplain of the Washington Redskins, and he speaks all over the place. He's also now on staff with the SBC of Virginia, which is the denominational group we're a part of in Virginia. And so I'm just really excited for you that you get to hear him next week, and I look forward to hearing more about that. So, some have said that the greatest professional basketball game that was ever played was played in March 2nd, 1962. It was played by, there was a game in Pennsylvania, and one of the guys on the floor was a player by the name of Wilt Chamberlain. Now, Chamberlain was about 7'1", and that's not unusual now, but it was not so common then. There are a lot of 7-footers that play the game now, but often they are people who are just men who are, they're big, and they're playing because they're huge. And they're a little uncoordinated, but that was not the case with Wilt Chamberlain. It was said that he was as big as an oak tree and just as graceful as a ballet dancer. But one of the things, in this particular game in March of 1962, he scored 100 points, which is, that happens occasionally in high school and college, but it's the only time it's ever happened in professional basketball. In fact, that year, he averaged 50 points a game. And some say that, you know, it's a record that will never be broken. But in that particular game, he made 28 of 32 free throws. And the reason why that's unusual is that he typically was a terrible free throw shooter. He typically made about 40% of his free throws, but that night he shot 87%. And what was going on was that he was that year, he was attempting a new style. One of the other guys that played around the time he played was a guy by the name of Rick Barry. And Rick Barry was an unbelievably accurate free throw shooter, typically shot close to and was 95% accuracy. Some years he only missed like 9 or 10 free throws a year. Just by contrast, LeBron James typically misses about 150 free throws in a year. But Rick Barry shot his free throws what is called granny style. So that means that he would shoot his free throws like this, you know, and throw it underhand. And if you talk to him, he's still alive. He said, you know, it's just a more natural motion. He said, this is not a natural motion to stand and shoot like this. But, it, you know, arms down is more natural, and it's a softer touch. And he was just, you know, he was able to back up his odd strategy with a tremendous amount of accuracy. The reason I tell you this story is that particular night, I mean, this Chamberlain shot that incredible percentage rate, but after that year was over, he went back to shooting them the other way and went back to being a terrible free throw shooter. And that's odd because if for these huge men who shoot poorly, they often have to be taken out at the end of the game because the other team knows that if they can just foul that guy, then he's going to miss and they'll get the ball back. So it makes a huge person like that a liability. But the reason that Wilt Chamberlain stopped doing it was just that it was weird and he felt like it made him look weak And so he was kind of embarrassed by shooting free throws that way, and he stopped. Rick Barry said that, you know, later he's worked with other guys. He worked with Shaquille O'Neal. He tried to get him to shoot this way. Another enormous man who was a great player, except he was a terrible free throw shooter. But Shaq said, I'd rather shoot 0% than shoot my free throws granny style, because he was just embarrassed by that. And, you know, that's just, there's, I tell you that story, I don't know if that's going to sit there or not, but I tell you that story just because, to get you to think a little bit about the idea of being embarrassed. And there's a couple of ways that sometimes we can embarrass ourselves, and there's, you know, they were embarrassed about doing something different. There's once when I was in my very first church, I sang this great big solo right before the pastor was getting ready to preach. And after I sang and I was starting down the steps, I had brand new shoes on, and my feet flew out from under me, and I hit the floor. This was before Kat and I were married. She was sitting right there. She busted out laughing. I married her anyway. But, you know, and it's funny, though, the older you get, the less that sort of kind of embarrassment bothers you a whole lot. I mean, I guess when you get older, you've embarrassed yourself in that sort of way so many times, maybe you just don't care anymore. But when we're younger, we worry more about that. But there's another kind of embarrassment that comes from just foolishness, from thinking back to things in your life, and I call them just cringe moments. And when I look back, and there are several things, and I won't either bore you or shock you with details there, but I look back at things that I've done, and I think, oh my goodness, how could I have been so stupid? How could I have been so immature? And there are things like that that either we're embarrassed about them, or there are others, you know, if we were being really honest in the room today, there are things you could look back and say, if I just listened, if I hadn't done this, if I hadn't done that, the thing that stupid action cost me, it was just overwhelming, and I wish that I hadn't done it. You know, we expect children to act like children, and we expect teens to act like teens. I mean, we can only be where we are, but there are sometimes when adults who ought to know better act in embarrassing ways that it creates those sorts of cringe moments. And you know, unless you've got some sort of disease, then you're going to grow up physically, but emotional maturity and just life maturity, and certainly not spiritual maturity, is not automatic. And all of us have a disease called pride that gets in the way of us listening to God and causes us to cause at least embarrassing moments where we just grieve over things that we've done in the past or recently, or worse, that we actually harm the cause of Christ through what we do. So this question for us to think about this morning, is there a way to speed up growing up? Is there a way to speed up growing up? And of course, the truth is, no, there isn't. But there are ways to make sure that we keep it on track. You know, one of the ways that I think that we embarrass ourselves at especially when we're younger, is through boasting. And of course, in sports and sometimes now in politics, that's a sort of thing. You know, I'm the greatest, and you should pay attention to me, and all of that sort of thing. That sort of thing is embarrassing and cringeworthy behavior. But that's not the sort of greatness that the Bible talks about. Rather, real greatness, as we're going to look at in this text, real greatness comes from an ambition to follow Jesus in serving and suffering for the good of others. Real greatness comes from an ambition. In this case, this is an area where we're to be ambitious, and I'll show you that from the text, to follow Jesus in serving and suffering for the good of others. This message is called Misunderstanding Greatness, or How to Avoid Embarrassing Ourselves. And it's from Mark chapter 10, verses 32 through 45. And it's the last message in this series we've been doing called Stuff Jesus Talks About, But We Don't. Stuff Jesus Talks About, But We Don't. From Mark chapters 8 through 10, where there's like this intensive season where Jesus is instructing his apostles, and it began by them becoming aware at a more thorough level of who Jesus is And as soon as they could see that, then Jesus began to explain to them that he was going to suffer many things and die. And the disciples, it so didn't fit their image of what Jesus was and what it was going to be like for them to follow him, that they protested it, and then they didn't get it, because he went on to explain to them that since I'm going to suffer, that means that I'm calling you to die to yourself and to take up your cross and follow me. But they still argued about who was the greatest. They tried to hurry children away from Jesus. They were shocked when he said that they were to stay in marriages and to give of themselves in that way. I mean, they just persisted over and over in not getting what Jesus was talking about. And we saved probably the worst incident of that for the last here. So this message, for us to be able to do this, for us to be able to keep spiritual progress on track, we need to hear and apply what Jesus says. We need to recognize the danger of embarrassing ourselves when we don't. And then finally, to aim at genuine greatness. So look with me, if you will, at this idea of the importance of us hearing and applying what Jesus says from verses 32 through 34. And the text says, they, speaking of Jesus and his disciples and some other folks, they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed. And the they is an even broader group of people. The disciples were amazed, and those who were following were afraid. That was the larger group. And then it says, and taking the 12 again, Jesus began to tell them what was to happen to him. See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise. Now, the reality that the text specifically says that they're on their way to Jerusalem means Jesus knows precisely what he's going to Jerusalem to do, that he's going there to die. And that reality, that's constantly on his mind. That colors everything that he is about. And in this instance, he is explaining to them in greater detail. He's predicting to them what's going to happen when they get there. And that's been a theme throughout chapters 8 through 10, but it's more detailed here than it is anywhere else. And it's the sense I get as I look at this text, it's sort of as if Jesus, he's focusing on those 12 disciples, and he says, guys, I need you to gather around. I want you to pay attention. You don't seem to be getting this. He's patient with them. They said, you're not taking this in. You're not hearing me. So I want you to listen closely. And then in more detail than he's ever said, he explains to them what's going to happen. He says, I'm going to be rejected by the chief priests and the elders, and they're going to turn me over to the Gentiles. And this part was new. He'd never told them this before. And he said, they're going to mock me. They're going to spit on me. And so those two, mocking and spitting, it's hard to imagine something more degrading than someone spitting on you. And so those two are like, they're just something that the Roman government typically did when they were going to crucify someone, to just completely humiliate them, so that anyone who would dare consider to cross them or to do something they didn't want done would be blocked or terrified away from doing that sort of thing. But then he goes on to say, they're going to flog me. And you know, the New Testament doesn't linger at any point on the gory details of what happened in the crucifixion. And I think there's two reasons for that. I mean, one is I think that's not really the point, that we would focus on the gory details of that. And so I think that's a part of it. But secondly, for those that Mark was writing to, if they'd ever seen a flogging, if they'd ever seen a crucifixion, they would never be able to forget it. And it would be one of those things that they could wish that they could get out of their minds, but they couldn't shake it. And so Jesus is patiently going through these things with them. And the teaching, going back to chapter 8, verse 31, where he said, the reality that I'm going to suffer, listen guys, pay attention, the reality that I'm suffering, that's who I am, and you are followers of me, means that you also are going to be caught. It's going to be hard. They're going to be challenging things. And following me means giving of yourself and taking up your cross and follow me. And he patiently walks through all of that. But as we'll see, I mean, they were in danger, or they were doing what we're often in danger of, is just selective hearing. You know, where we hear what we want to hear. And they were just picking and choosing, and somehow they continued to miss this. For you and I to be able to keep spiritual maturity on track, we've got to hear and apply what Jesus says to us. I mean, negatively speaking, that means that, you know, when our family wants to watch a movie and you want to go out, we don't sulk about that. When at work, it seems that no one appreciates you, you don't sabotage what's going on. When someone hurts your feelings, you don't speak to someone else about it and about how terrible you've been treated unless you speak to that person directly. It means that even though you feel like you're an introvert, it means that you're willing to get out of yourself and be willing to speak to other people that you don't know well, because no one likes to be ignored. It means that we're willing to listen to people who think different than we do politically or whatever. It means that we don't arrange our life around just playing, although there's a place for playing, but that we arrange our lives toward following Jesus and giving ourselves for the sake of other people. And the way that we do that is to pray every morning and to say, Jesus, I want to give myself to you as a living sacrifice. I want to die to myself today. And also then when you're reading the Bible, or when you're listening to a message like this, or maybe you're in a small group, you're not just trying to hear it. You're not just trying to take it in, but you're moving along and seeking to understand it and to be able to then to apply it to new situations and to be able to analyze circumstances in your life and say, you know, what does this have to do with my home life? Or what does this happen to do with the situation at my work? Or what does this have to do with how I entertain myself? And all of those kinds of things that we seek to listen and apply what Jesus has to say. The problem is we can't do that. That's not what comes naturally to us. We're just like everybody else. What comes natural to us is that we think our ideas are better than everybody else, and we're all addicted to our own comfort at one degree or another. And if on our own, in our own strength, we will, just like the disciples, practice selective listening. We'll hear what we want to hear, and we'll take out of church life just what we'd like to take out of it and leave all the rest of it for the spiritual nuts. And we just take what we want. But there's some serious danger in that, as you'll see. So we need to hear and apply what Jesus says. Secondly, we need to recognize the danger of embarrassing ourselves and maybe harming the cause of Christ when we don't do this. Look at verses 35 through 40. It says, "And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to Jesus and said to him, 'Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you.'" Now, I just want you to know that what's on Jesus' mind right now, he has just walked through the details of how he's going to suffer. That's what's on his mind. Let's see what's on James and John's mind. Jesus says, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "Oh yeah, no problem." Something like that. Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink. And with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." James and John, they take Jesus off to the side here, sort of. They don't want anybody else to hear this conversation that they're wanting to have with him. And Jesus is not naive. There were plenty of other situations where Jesus read people's minds and sort of called them out before they said anything. But in this case, Jesus asked them to verbalize. He says, "So what do you want me to do for you?" And so then they got this request. Grant that when you come into your glory, grant that we, one of us sit on the right and one of us on the left. It's the only time in the Gospel of Mark that James and John appear by themselves. They are several, they're already part of the 12. But in every other case, when there's a select group, it's always Peter and James and John. But in this one case, they've left Peter out because there's only two sides to Jesus. And so Peter's out. Jesus' mind is on the cross. Their mind is on glory and power and the perks of being in power. That's what they're thinking about. And I can't help but want to ask myself is what in the world were they doing when Jesus was just talking about this stuff? How could they possibly be thinking about what the perks for them were going to be when Jesus had just explained to them that he was going to be mocked and spit on and flogged? And they're still thinking about, what's in this for me? How's that possible? Because it just is. It's very possible for us to completely miss the point of what Jesus is talking about and still just kind of picking and choosing what we want to hear. So Jesus says, you know what, guys? You don't know what you're asking me. And of course, when he says, are you able to do what I'm going to do? And they're like, oh, yeah, no problem. We got that. And Jesus is like, well, yeah, in fact, you are. And when you keep reading in the New Testament, in Acts chapter 12, James, the same James here, Herod splits him open with a sword. He's the second martyr, if I'm counting correctly. His brother John, and by the way, so James, he didn't write anything. That's a different James that wrote the later book in the New Testament. He was gone pretty early, killed by Herod for his commitment to Jesus Christ. His brother John, the other of this pair here, is the one who was exiled to the Isle of Patmos, sort of like a first century Alcatraz, an island prison, and where he's sent off on his own. So in fact, both of these guys would suffer in similar ways that Jesus would suffer. But Jesus says, you don't really understand what you're asking me. It's interesting also that Jesus, he also doesn't say, there's these places that you're talking about in my right or my left. He doesn't say that that's not a thing. And it's interesting because if you were just reading a few verses back, he talks about the first being last and the last being first. Whatever those sorts of seats very likely would be for people that you and I will never hear of in this life. It won't be for the very well-known believers throughout the centuries. It'll be those sorts of places of honor will be for someone that we've never heard of. But when we have these moments where Jesus is communicating to us through his word, or for us, all of his word, but we don't pay much attention to it, we don't read it for ourselves, or when someone's preaching like this, we're doing something else, not paying attention, don't see any relevance to our lives, and that sort of attitude is what leads to these moments of tremendous grief later, or tremendous embarrassment, thinking, what in the world? Why did I not pay attention? Why did I not listen? Why did I not apply this to my life? Clint Hill was a Secret Service agent from the President Eisenhower all the way through President Ford. And he's recently written a book called Five Presidents. And what you would know about this guy is that if you've ever seen the video of the Kennedy assassination, he is the Secret Service agent that's climbing up on the back of the limousine trying to get to Mrs. Kennedy and the president immediately after those shots are fired there in Dallas. And the book's been very popular, and he's actually written two others about his time, and some even more specifically on that. But it's fascinating reading and to listen. But also, the Secret Service themselves, they've gone over and over and over that video, and they've listened to what he had to say because he was there. He was experienced that in the moment, and they wanted to learn from what he had to say. And how foolish and what a revolt there would have been if the Secret Service had chosen not to learn anything from that experience. And then the same sort of things kept happening because they refused to learn the lessons from someone that had actually gone through it. The Bible makes it very clear that part of the reason that Jesus was here was that he would walk in our shoes And God's perspective on this life has been captured in a book. And those words to us are as more relevant today than they've ever been. There's nothing out of date about them. Some of it has to be interpreted. But when we refuse to listen and apply it to our lives, then we just keep making the same mistakes over and over. And it's far more tragic than it would be to ignore the learning from an assassination. And you know, when we focus on ourselves, that often leads to embarrassment. I mean, people can tell, you know, when our favorite subject is me, people can tell that about you. And guys, maybe girls do this, I don't know, but guys, if you're staring at another woman's body, you know, sometimes people catch you doing that. They catch you just sort of grossly staring at someone else. I mean, people see that, and it doesn't make you look good. When people misbehave on their computers through pornography or sexting or on their phones, other things like that, those sorts of things eventually come out. I mean, you may fool your parents some, maybe a lot. You may fool other people a lot of the time, but you never fool God. And eventually our sins find us out. They come back to haunt us. When we don't listen, that leads to bad things. When a person loses their, when they kind of lose it, they lose their temper in front of other people, that doesn't make them look good. We refuse to apply God's word to us. It's why we're to live remembering Jesus' suffering for us, that he was mocked for you, that he was spat on for you, that he was flogged for you, that he died for you. And people who follow them then are people, they don't go around demanding their rights. They're people who lay them down willingly. So again, we do this by, instead of checking out or just, you know, having a super casual attitude about when we're in worship or not, or about whether we ever pick up the word of God or not, but that we're diligent to read and to listen and to attend. And then we're diligent to get real specific with ourselves. How does this apply to my work? How does this apply to what I do on my computer or on my phone? How does this apply to my dating life? How does this apply to the words that come out of my mouth or the thoughts that are in my mind? Because when we ignore what God has to say to us about all of these things, embarrassment is certain to follow, and maybe embarrassment to the cause of Christ altogether. And the results of that are more tragic than ignoring an assassination attempt. So we need to hear and apply what Jesus has to say, recognize the consequences of not doing that, and then finally to aim at genuine greatness. James and John weren't the only ones thinking about themselves here. As you keep reading, it says, "And when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John." The reason they're mad is because they didn't think of this idea first, that they didn't get to Jesus first to ask if they could sit in those seats. Meaning that they're just as selfish, just as self-focused as James and John were, maybe just a little slower. And so it says, Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them, but it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." I'm intrigued by that phrase there when it says that they began to be indignant. It reminds me of those kinds of situations when someone wrongs us, and then we dwell on it. We meditate on it. We turn it over, and we look at every angle. And the more we think about the way they've wronged us, the angrier we get. And that's the kind of situation that I think is going on there. But here's this is huge, and I don't want you to miss this. Jesus does not waste this conflict. Look at what happens here. There's conflict on this team among the people that he's working directly with. He doesn't ignore it. He doesn't sweep it under the rug. He confronts it head on, and he brings the principal people into a room, and he says, "Hey, we're going to talk about this. We're going to get this out." And he doesn't he doesn't rebuke them for their selfishness. He doesn't berate them. If they're embarrassed, he doesn't, you know, he's gentle with them about that. He's patient and he instructs them. You see, when conflict is normal, the presence of conflict in your family, the presence of conflict in your workplace, the presence of conflict in your ministry, the presence of conflict in a church, it's just a sign that there are other people involved. It's no sign that Jesus isn't present or engaged. I mean, that's clearly one of the emphases here. I mean, Jesus is right there. It's happening right under his nose, and so we shouldn't freak out when there's conflict. I mean, right on Jesus' team, he doesn't have it all rooted out, so we shouldn't be surprised when it happens. And so I'd like, before we go on there, I mean, just to think about, I mean, there are people in all of our lives where we've sorted, and maybe I would just like for you to think, is there some way that you've just kind of written off? You know what? I'm done with that. I'm done with that person. I don't trust them. I don't want to work with them. I don't want to have anything to do with them anymore. I mean, think about what Jesus has to say here about this. You see, we don't work things out by insisting on our own way or just continuing to persist that we're right. When we do that, that's a way of trying to lord it over. It's trying to be the boss, and it's demanding our own way. And depending on how we relate to that, whether it's pouting or being passive-aggressive or just changing friends or changing churches or changing spouses. You see, Jesus says that's the way the world does it. In the world, the great, the people who are great in the world, they get their own way. But in the kingdom, the great give up their way. Greatness means becoming a servant of all, not demanding rights, being a slave of all. And the way Jesus talks about this means that we're to be ambitious for this kind of greatness. We're to aim at this. We're to look for opportunities to serve and look for opportunities to lay down our lives for other people. We're willing to hear other people out, where we're giving folks the benefit of the doubt, where we're quietly blessing others that no one will ever hear about, where we're willing to shed tears over people that we're concerned about, whether anyone else will ever know about that or not. I mean, Jesus was God himself. He was the creator of everything that exists, but he demanded no rights when he was here on the earth. Rather, he gave himself as a ransom. And that's an interesting word. A ransom has to be paid because someone's been kidnapped, someone's been in prison, someone's been taken. And that is the truth about you and me. We've been kidnapped, imprisoned, taken by our own selfishness, prisoner to our own pleasure, addicted to our own comfort. And we have no ability to free ourselves from that. And so Jesus did what only he could do for us by giving himself as a ransom for many. And we aim at greatness by acknowledging that addiction to comfort, by recognizing that we're hopeless to escape it on our own, and then trusting Jesus suffering on our behalf for us. You know, greatness in sports, in business, in academics, in physical strength, in beauty. I mean, that's in many of those arenas, that's a very limited field of people who can get to what would be considered greatness in that area. But real greatness is available to anyone who follows Jesus. So I want you to imagine a family, imagine a ministry, imagine a church increasingly full of people seeking to outdo one another in being great as Jesus defines it. Bethany Place, let's be that church. For God's sake, let's be that kind of church. Would you pray with me? Jesus, I pray that you would make us ambitious. I pray that you would make us ambitious for this, that we'd be willing to be the slave of all, as hard as that grates against what comes naturally to us. And Father, for those in the room who have never in the first place surrendered, been willing to acknowledge that they really have, that they really are a slave to their own sin, their own selfishness, because that's what comes naturally to each of us. That they would recognize today and see and believe that you died for them, you were mocked for them, you were spat on for them, and that this very day and this very moment would be the moment that you would open their eyes to see that that's what it took for them to be set free, for us to be set free. And if you're in this room this day and you've never acknowledged that to Jesus and you have never trusted in the payment of Jesus' ransom to pay for your sin, your imprisonment, I ask you to cry out for mercy to God in this moment. But for those of us who are believers, that we've already taken that step, there is clearly a tremendous amount for us to apply, because our old selfish nature is still very much alive inside of us. And I pray that you would allow God to finish the work that he has done in you just today, that he's doing in our hearts through this text today, that you would allow him to press further, to make it very clear what he's calling you to do specifically in your life. Father, I pray that you would take these final moments of the service where we allow you to finalize in us what you want to do in us. I ask that you would provoke each of us to pray. And Father, for those who need to make a public commitment, pray that you grant them the courage to not be embarrassed about that, but to be willing to set aside any awkwardness they feel and being in front of people and be willing to be identified with you. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.